The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So this afternoon, I would like to continue with the custom here at IMC that the first talk of the year is on the Four Noble Truths. And so I did it on first talk for Sunday, took first talk for Monday, and now the first day-long talk of the year. And I find the Four Noble Truths to be really useful set of teachings because it can be applied in so many different ways. It can be interpreted so many different ways. And in fact, down through the centuries, it has been interpreted many ways. And I'd like to think of that as the creative efforts of people to address their life, the suffering in their life, and to explore it or apply it or understand suffering in useful ways for the situations they're in, the time, the places they're in. And here in the modern world, people are still finding this teaching called the Four Noble Truths to be useful. Thing to use as a reference point, as an exploration, as a litmus test, as a mirror, as a tool to take through our lives and be with us. And the tradition holds it up often as the first teachings of the Buddha. Down through the centuries, Buddhists have claimed all kinds of things were the first teachings of the Buddha. So that's nice that he was so, you know, so many things were for the first. And the Theravadan tradition holds that there's a Four Noble Truths. And to place what happens in the history of Buddhism is Buddhists will place in the mouth of the Buddha, as his first teaching, whatever they thought was particularly important. And so for Theravadan Buddhists, the Four Noble Truths came to become the most important, central and most important teachings. And so it looks like it was probably, you know, conveniently placed into his first sermon because then it seems particularly important. And I think it is important. It's a valuable teaching. And what I'd like to do today is to give the, kind of just read to you the most classic way that this teaching is preserved from a text that's supposed to be the Buddha's first teaching. So it has that, you know, it has a high value in the tradition, this particular set of teachings. And so the Four Noble Truths are four statements that could be sound like propositions, like certain like tenets or beliefs, but I think the tradition takes them to be statements of not so much philosophical truths, but practical truths, or kind of the same have the same practicality that if you cut your finger, it's true that it'll probably heal better if you clean it and put a Band-Aid on it. That's probably a true statement, and it's a practical truth, or pragmatic truth. And these four statements of the truths are that it's the most simple way of stated is that there's a noble truth of suffering, the noble truth of the arising of suffering, the noble truth of the cessation of suffering, and the noble truth of the way to the cessation of the suffering, or the noble truth to the way. And then there's explanations of what these four statements are supposed to mean. The word noble is I guess it's kind of like an adjective, noble truths. The more common meaning of the term and how the tradition often understands it is it's not an adjective, but rather refers to the people particular set of people, the noble people. And so it's literally, more literally, the the truth of the noble ones. So the truth of the noble ones are the ones who have tasted or seen or the truth of some of these Four Noble Truths and made it their own. They say, oh yeah, this makes sense for me. I see this. I realize this. This is completely obvious to me. And I can orient my life around these things. This is how I can, the framework in which I can see my life in a way that's very productive and useful. And so these people are said to be, I like the word, English word noble, because in my little mind at least, it means something like dignified, upright. So that to become a dignified, certain kind of dignity or uprightness or strength that comes with having these Four Noble Truths, these Four Truths of the Noble Ones in your, you know, as a reference point, as a tool, as a something you use to go through life with. And so then there's an explanation of these four statements. And so the first noble truth, the first truth of the noble ones, this is the truth of suffering. The suffering of birth, the suffering of aging, the suffering of illness, the suffering of death, the suffering of being connected to what is displeasing, the suffering of being separated from what is pleasing, the suffering of not getting what one wants, and stated briefly, the suffering of the five aggregates of clinging. So these are pretty common experiences: birth, aging, illness, death, and then having to kind of spend time with things you don't like. That's a pretty common human experience. And having to spend time away from things that you like, things that you cherish, is pretty common. And a very common one, for some people, something that happens on a regular basis, like every couple of minutes, the suffering of not getting what one wants. And especially people who have a lot of desire, there's a lot of things to want. That world is filled with things to want. And so, you know, desires can keep rolling out, and we don't get them. So it's kind of undeniable that these things involve some degree of distress, disappointment, discouragement, distress. One Zen teacher I knew, he translated this word dukkha here, not as suffering, but as anguish. And he tried to convince me that that was a good translation. And I just couldn't get behind it. But still, anguish. Sometimes that's how it is, you know, in certain situations. So the word dukkha is translated here as suffering. Is the kind of the opposite of sukha. And sukha sometimes is translated as happiness. But there's somehow, you know, sukha, dukkha, they kind of go together. And do, the prefix do in Pali is basically a prefix for things that are bad. And the prefix su is basically things that are good. So you know, so kind of that's kind of the general area. But I kind of like to translate these two as ease and unease. And so I like the word unease as a translation for dukkha. And but that doesn't quite capture the power and strength of some people's distress or suffering around these things. But dukkha is a range, from the lightest little, mildest little unease to the greatest existential suffering that we can have. So it's kind of undeniable that there can be suffering connected to these things. So the truth of suffering has that truth that's connected to birth, aging, illness, death, being connected to what is displeasing, separated from what is pleasing, and not getting what one wants. So there's a duty, or I don't like the word duty, there's a task or a practice connected to each of the Four Noble Truths. And the connected to the First Noble Truth, the activity that's connected to it is to understand it. And just a nice, maybe you'll allow me this privilege. I really like the fact that the word understand in English means, kind of looks like it means to stand under. And so I don't know how we ended up with, you know, understand to mean to know something well. But anyway, that's what we have in English, to stand under. So to take a stand with suffering, to stand under it or stand on top of it or to stand upright in the middle of it, I think for me almost works better than to understand, like in terms of knowledge and to analyze and figure it out. At least a very important part of mindfulness practice is cultivating, developing the ability to stay present for our discomfort, for our unease, for our stress, for our anguish, for our suffering. And to take a stand, not to take a stand like a position, like a before or against it, but to be able to stand upright, to sit upright in the midst of it. And really kind of not run away, not push it away, not kind of get anxious and run around in circles like a trapped, you know, rat or something, but to really just stand and be willing to be in the midst of it, to be able to, I don't want to say the word accept it, but it's close to accept it. It means to allow it, but to do it, remember this word nobility, in a dignified way, to willing to hold your own, hold your ground, not succumb to it, not give up to it, not be pushed around by your suffering, not to feel pity because of it, not to be afraid, but to really kind of show up for it, and here, I'm here, a certain kind of strength, and show up in a strong way. What would that mean for you, to show up to your suffering and to stand in it, to stand with it, to take a stand in the middle of it, or to be upright in the middle of it? How would that look like for you compared to maybe some of the ways that you do respond? Shutting down or attacking or blaming or getting angry or despairing or turning on the TV. All kinds of choices people make. And for some people, it's very freeing, very meaningful to learn how to be present for suffering without turning away, without judging it or bringing all kinds of analysis on it, like this means I'm a failure, this means that life is a bad place to be, this means that it's better to watch TV. So all kinds of ideas, but just got to be very simple. And the simplicity of just being with discomfort in a simple, ordinary way, not being for or against it, but just being present. Some people find just profoundly meaningful, especially people who are used to living, growing up in a culture or society or group of people where suffering was denied or avoided at all costs. And to have, you know, and they said, something's wrong here in this world. There is suffering, but no one's looking at it. No one's talking about it. And then take a stand in it to really say, yes, it's here. Not to celebrate it, but just not to suffer better. But to the first task is to understand it to see it clearly and then to take a stand there, to stand under it, to stand on it. Maybe it's better to stand on it than stand under it. So it's the task is not to understand, but to onstand. Am I allowed to make new words? And so then the second noble truth is explained this way. It's the truth of the arising of suffering. It is this craving that leads to further becoming, accompanied with delight and lust, seeing delight here and there. This is craving for sensual pleasures, craving for becoming, and craving for non-becoming. So the word becoming appears a number of times in this text. And sometimes it's translated as existence, to exist, to be. It comes from the word to be or to become. And some people like to understand this in a practical sense of taking on an identity. Like you want to be something or be someone. And sometimes it's understood having to do with being reborn, so taking on a new life, identity as a new person after you die and get reborn again. And whether it means, has something to do with multiple births or just means in this moment, in this day today, how many times have you been become something new? If you stood in line to go to the toilet today, did you get born? Did you become, the perfect line stander? Worried about how other people thought that you were standing there, and what does it mean to stand there? And all these identity issues came up. And you became something, maybe, or how you ate your lunch, and did I bring the right lunch and to a meditation center? So those are all, that maybe I should, I don't want to be someone, this way. So anyway, becoming, so craving, so the craving that leads to becoming, leads to craving identity or existing as some kind of thing, which in Buddhist analysis is often seen as a pretty fragile thing to do. Once we cling and hold on to an identity or having to be a certain way, then reality tends to challenge that, because anything that's fixed tends to kind of not really fluid to adapt and change with how we change and how the world changes. And the word here for craving literally means thirst. And here also is a very nice word. It's maybe nice to translate it as thirst rather than craving, because it's such a physical thing, thirst. So you can feel it, you can know thirst. Craving sometimes, like, it's a little bit abstract, the idea, but thirst is kind of visceral, kinesthetic, or somatic kind of thing. And then that talks about it's thirst. It's accompanied by delight and lust, seeking delight here and there. And for some reason, this tradition feels that the craving that gets us into most trouble is the craving that's seeking delight, that has lust as part of it, looking for pleasure, looking for joy, looking for something nice. And it's a little bit odd, because it's a tradition that talks about becoming happy. But maybe happiness and delight are two different things. Certainly happiness and lust are very different from each other. And so here, I think what's being talked about is that it isn't that craving is the cause of all these sufferings that is listed in the first truth, but rather craving is the suffering that's connected to it. That if you have some kind of thirsting or craving, then in that very act of craving itself is suffering. It's painful, it's stressful, it's uneasy to have it. There's something about the tightness, the pressure, the compulsion, the drivenness of craving, thirsting for something, that is painful to have. And you can feel, in particularly if you feel like you really want something and you can't put it down, and you can feel that that something is, you're not free. There's no freedom in yourself if there's some kind of compulsive drive inside of you that's maybe even forcing you to do things against your will. And certainly there are people who are addicts. It's the obvious example of people who maybe even don't even want to drink or smoke or do what they do, but they just can't stop themselves. So it feels very uncomfortable to kind of lose control that way. So this is one of the reasons why this tradition puts so much emphasis on looking at this, the affect or the feeling tone, the experience of craving. Because it's really it's not the source of suffering, it is suffering. It is kind of the very nature of suffering is to crave. And if we can somehow not be caught in the grip of this intense wanting or thirsting, then then the suffering, you know, is alleviated, is abated, is brought to an end. The task involved with the second noble truth is to let go, is to let go of the craving. And it's easier said than done, for sure, but that's the task, is to learn how to do that, to develop ourselves, to develop the strength of heart, strength of courage, strength of fluidity, flexibility, to be able to let go when we're caught in the grip, when there's craving and wanting, this kind of thing. The third noble truth is the truth of the cessation of suffering, and it's described as, it is the complete fading away and cessation of that same craving. And to emphasize that how complete this is, it says, it's the giving up and relinquishing of it, freedom from it, non-reliance on it. I kind of like the word non-reliance. Too many people rely on craving. Some people believe in craving. And otherwise, why would you hang out with it and, you know, live by it? It's going to do you something good, so you believe in the value of it. So, you know, get a good craving going is good, right? But non-reliance on it. The complete fading away and cessation of the same craving. And it's meant to be the good news in Buddhism. This is where the happiness begins coming, where suffering, you don't have to be stuck in your suffering, but it's possible to, at some point, to let go of the suffering, to let go of the craving. It's kind of synonymous. Craving and suffering are almost here. It's treated as synonyms of each other. And if we can let go. So we let go of the craving, and then we experience a cessation. We experience the end of that suffering. And that is really great. And then a task for this third noble truth is to realize that cessation. And so to realize is more than to understand. It's to experience, is to live, to embody, to step into the full experience of what it's like to have the cessation of suffering. And one of the ways I understand this is that if you have some release of some craving, some suffering that you have, even if it's very temporary, even if it's small, some small thing, it's nourishing to take the time to recognize that and to feel what that's like. Be informed by that. Take it in. Some people could suffer about something, for example, want something really strongly, and then for some reason that wanting falls away. Maybe they let go of it, or maybe they just get distracted. So that's nice, but there's so much momentum in the mind to want other things and to be concerned about other things that we're on to the next thing. You know, there's a lot of things, there's a long list of things you could be suffering about. And so some people have this backlog. So, you know, they don't take the time to appreciate the fact that this suffering is gone because they're on to the next one. And that's unfortunate. Because the instruction is to realize it, is take the time to feel what that's like, even if it's very small. I like the idea that it's nourishing, that it's supportive. It kind of re-educates. It's a retraining of the whole inner system. To begin to appreciate and value something is to support it, to let it grow and let it cultivate it. So if we can take the time to experience what this absence of craving, the absence of suffering is like, then we learn to value that, appreciate it, we learn to recognize it, we learn to feel that this is valuable, and maybe it's more valuable than clinging. As long as the unconscious thinks that it's more valuable to get things than it is to be free, the unconscious is going to keep wanting to get things, to want things. But if we can re-educate the unconscious by feeling how good it is to not be caught in the grip of craving, to feel the ease or the freedom, the lightness, the openness, the expansiveness that can come with that, then perhaps we can do this retraining of the inner life. The The fourth noble truth is the truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. And this is explained as the Eightfold Path. And this is a whole set of practices that are meant to be undertaken to support our ability to do the first three tasks. As we cultivate and develop our ethics, cultivate and develop our minds, cultivate and develop our understanding, then we create a kind of stability in the mind and a clarity in the mind that helps us to see more and more clearly. And this particular Buddhist tradition puts a tremendous emphasis on clear seeing. And the more we can do to create stability and steadiness in the mind so we can see clearly, then the better we can kind of begin doing these other tasks. We can understand suffering. We can let go of the craving. We can realize cessation. And so in order to do that, and I think this is a very mature part of the tradition, it talks about the task for the Fourth Noble Truth is to cultivate the Eightfold Path. And why I like this as a very mature thing is that it's a recognition that this takes time and that we have to put in the time to cultivate and develop ourselves. It's not something that can be done. It's not like a magic, you know, instant enlightenment kind of thing. I was told a story once of the Dalai Lama. I think he was talking in big, huge auditorium in maybe Arizona someplace. And he was talking about maybe the path of practice. And someone raised his hand and asked Dalai Lama in front of thousands of people maybe, and said, what's the quick way to enlightenment? And the way the story was told to me, the Dalai Lama was silent for a while, just stood there, so it was kind of poignant silence, and he started to cry. Isn't that something? He started to cry. And then finally he answered, and it was something about the idea that we're supposed to get it quickly, that not really do the work to cultivate and develop ourselves, and the kind of certain kind of greed or certain kind of egotism, maybe with, I'm going to get something quickly, I'm going to get it now, and it's for me, and quick and fast, right? I mean, it'd be great if all of us can get enlightened quickly, because there's all these important things to do in life, you know, great things you can do, and more devices to buy, and, you know, all kinds of great things, right? So just, you know, it's this enlightenment thing is slowing you down. You know, you want to get enlightened, but, you know, quick. You've been listening to all the popular messages that our society offers, and so there's all kinds of things you should do, right? So let's get this enlightenment over quickly. But so anyway, this idea of Dalai Lama crying with this idea. So I think there's something very mature about stepping into the path of practice and just giving yourself to this slow, steady, dedicated development of personal qualities that support this way. And it's meant to be something very personal. It's meant to be develop those qualities that helps you become a better person, helps you become have a mind and heart which is stable, clear, open, compassionate, kind, relaxed, soft, so that your heart becomes a place that you want to go home to. So it's nice in there. You like being in yourself. Isn't that nice? I think the idea is to like yourself, to like what's in here, to be happy to go spend time with yourself, because it's you've developed and cultivated something really nice that feels good. So four tasks: to understand, to let go, to realize, and to cultivate. So to understand suffering, to let go of craving, to realize cessation, and to cultivate the Eightfold Path. This is the kind of the core, kind of central teachings for some people around which the whole Buddha Dharma thing kind of operates, and everything else is kind of supports the ability to do those things. And that's why I like to emphasize this at the beginning of the year, so that we have something to do this year. So, thank you. And then...